From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. A panel of appeals court judges heard oral arguments last week in the latest phase of a legal challenge to Florida's tax credit scholarship program that helps children from low-income families attend private schools. The state teachers union is the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit, contending the program violates the state constitution. Supporters say it provides educational opportunities to students who otherwise wouldn't have access to them. Plus, executions are on hold in Florida amid challenges to the way the state imposes the death penalty. The Florida legislature passed a revision to the state's death penalty law after the U.S. Supreme Court declared the state's death sentencing system unconstitutional in January. Opponents recently argued that all of Florida's nearly 400 death row inmates should have their sentences changed to life in prison. A look at the future of the death penalty in Florida. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Florida's death penalty law and the fate of the state's nearly 400 death row inmates remains in flux. Last week, a Miami-Dade judge ruled that Florida's newly revised death penalty sentencing law is unconstitutional. That ruling came in the case of Karen Gator, who awaits trial for first-degree murder. Judge Milton Hirsch ruled that the law goes against the longtime sanctity of unanimous verdicts in death penalty cases because the system only requires 10 of 12 jurors to vote in favor of imposing execution. Just days before that ruling, Florida Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments in the case of death row inmate Timothy Lee Hurst. In the Hurst case, the U.S. Supreme Court declared Florida's death sentencing system unconstitutional earlier this year, arguing it gave too little power to juries. In response, the Florida legislature passed a revision of the law requiring 10 of 12 jurors to agree on imposing the death penalty. In the Hurst case, opponents of the law argue that all 390 of Florida's death row inmates should have their sentences changed to life in prison because they were convicted under a flawed system. While executions in Florida are currently suspended amid the legal wrangling, the state has the second highest number of inmates on death row in the U.S. and is one of the most active when it comes to actually carrying out executions. Florida is among just three states that have carried out executions in each of the past 5 years, along with Texas and Oklahoma. Joining me now for a closer look at the legal battle and the future of the death penalty in Florida is Susanna Nesmith. She's a freelance journalist in Miami and former reporter and editor for the Miami Herald, where she's covered legal affairs and crime. She also reports with the legal team at Bloomberg News, covering court cases, and she's a correspondent with the Columbia Journalism Review's United States Project, and her work has appeared in a variety of national and international publications. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks for having me.
We're also speaking with Republican State Representative Ross Spano of Dover. Representative Spano was a sponsor of the bill revamping Florida's death sentencing law passed this year. Thanks so much for your time, Representative Spano.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
And we're joined by Robert Dunham. He's executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Death Penalty Information Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation. Connect with our guests by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Representative Spano, I'll go ahead and start with you because I know we'll need to let you go in a few minutes here. But tell me a bit about the bill that you were a sponsor for that passed revamping death sentencing.
Well, sure. Had to do something based on the Hearst case that came down in January. We were early in session, actually, when that case was rendered, the decision was rendered. So with the help of some folks around the state, we were able to draft a bill that we think is constitutional and complied with the then existing Supreme Court precedent and state court precedent. Essentially, what it does is it addresses the Hearst Court's concerns that the jury did not have the decision-making authority as to whether or not the death penalty should be imposed, and essentially gave too much of that power to the judge. We also took an opportunity to change what the requirements were with respect to the number of jurors that would have to render a decision with regard to the death penalty. So in short, what the new law does essentially is, number one, require a unanimous verdict of guilt. Number two, requires a unanimous decision by all 12 jurors that a single aggravating factor has been satisfied that justifies the death penalty. And then after that decision has been made, it requires 10 of those 12 jurors to decide that that aggravating factor outweighs any mitigating circumstance, then that recommendation, if life sentence is the decision of the jury, that must be that sentence must be rendered. If the death penalty is imposed or is suggested by the jury, then that decision is taken up and reviewed by the court, and the court can depart downward, and notwithstanding a jury's recommendation of death, can render a decision of a life sentence. But it cannot, the judge cannot depart upward if the jury imposes a recommendation of life, and life sentence cannot impose upward to the death penalty. So I'm sure we'll get into the case law, the precedent in terms of the state court cases and Supreme Court cases, but we feel confident that what we have done passes constitutional muster.
And I'm curious as to the changing the requirement for 10 of 12 jurors agreeing on a death sentence instead of just requiring a unanimous jury like most other states that have the death penalty. Was that something that was on the table, or why did that not happen, I guess?
Yeah, it was, and that's a fantastic question. To be quite candid with you, when I first found out about the Hearst case, I kind of thought that's where we would end up. The Senate's version of the bill required unanimity at all phases, including that last phase I just spoke about. The House's version of the bill started out at a 9-3 recommendation. And the reason we ended up with a 10-2 as a compromise between the House and the Senate is because we found that there were a number of very high-profile cases that I could, certainly list for you. They would include the Ted Bundy case, the case involving Eileen Warnos, also a gentleman by the name of Joe Dixon. But I'm sure you recognize the first two cases. Serial murderers, heinous killers, whose death sentence recommendation was rendered only by a 10-2 decision in each of those instances. And so we determined and found out, and based on kind of a public policy determination, that there are those circumstances in which the heinous nature of a killing warrants the death penalty, and that we didn't want to be in a situation where a rogue juror, so to speak, could really thwart the will of the jury and the decision about whether or not to render the death penalty in an appropriate circumstance would pivot on that one rogue juror.
All right. Well, Representative Spano, thanks so much for your time. I know you need to get going, but really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks. And Susanna, can you take us back to, January and the U.S. Supreme Court's declaration regarding Florida's death sentencing system? What was their concern specifically regarding the constitutionality of the system here in Florida?
Well, it's interesting because the oral arguments on both sides in that case focused very specifically on the fact that Florida does not require a unanimous verdict for the death phase. They do require a unanimous verdict for the guilt phase. But the Supreme Court didn't rule on that specific issue. So the Supreme Court kind of left the legislature in a bind because the ruling was not very clear. The ruling said that the verdict for death has to be rendered by the jury, not the judge. And though Florida did have the ability, Florida judges did have the ability to override a jury that voted for life and impose death, no judge in Florida has done that since the 1990s. In fact, Alabama is the only place where that happens now. And 20% of Alabama's death row inmates are there on judicial overrides. Now, because the Supreme Court didn't say anything about unanimity, the legislature came up with what they believed is a constitutional law to address what the Supreme Court did say. Here in Miami, we have a judge who said no. A verdict means unanimity in a criminal case. And since the Supreme Court said we need a jury verdict, we need a unanimous one. And the Supreme Court has also asked Alabama to go explain how their law, which also requires a 10-2 majority to vote for death, how their law is constitutional.
And, you know, just to get us some perspective here, Robert Dunham, can you give us some idea based on factors like how many people are on death row, how actively we do actually execute people here in Florida, and the sentencing system? How much of an outlier is the Sunshine State?
Florida is an outlier in a number of respects. First, the state has conducted 92 executions, which is among the most in the country. But it also sentences more people to death, a disproportionate number of people to death. And that's a product of the non-unanimity. Last year, for example, the United States was at an all-time low in the number of death sentences imposed, at 49, and yet Florida and Alabama combined produced almost one quarter of all those death sentences in cases in which there were non-unanimous juries. So what we're looking at is a practice that is almost unique. Alabama and Florida were the only states last year with non-unanimous jury verdicts leading to death sentences, and one that disproportionately puts people on death row.
And Susanna, let's look at this argument that Supreme Court justices recently heard regarding the 390 inmates on death row here in Florida, and that all of their sentences should be changed to life in prison. Tell us about that. Who's proposing that, and do you think that's likely to happen?
You know, it's a very interesting argument, and the attorneys for three of the men on death row have argued it, but also an amicus curiae brief has been filed by a bunch of very interesting people, former Florida Supreme Court justices, former judges, very distinguished criminal lawyers, the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Florida Capital Resource Center, and they are arguing, yeah, now it's time for life for everybody because we've been sentencing people under an unconstitutional law. There are 389 now people on death row. Well, technically Hearst is no longer on death row. But the of those, a reporter named Katie Sartoris of the Village's Daily Sun looked to see how many of them did not have unanimous verdicts and found, and she had to pull a whole bunch of cases because nobody in the state of Florida was tracking this, found that 287 of them did not have unanimous verdicts, like Hearst. So even if they don't say that all 389 need to be converted to life sentences, as these former justices are arguing and others, there is a very good argument that the ones that maybe the ones that have less than 10-2. There are people up there who the vote was 7-5. Or maybe the death penalty does need to be unanimous, just like every other state but Alabama, Delaware, and Florida. And Delaware doesn't have any judicial overrides, by the way. This has all still got to be worked out in the courts. It would have been much easier if the Supreme Court had said, the argument was over unanimity, here is where we stand on that.
And an issue that's been brought up by Justices Barbara Pariente and Peggy Quince is that of allowing jurors to recommend the death penalty based on a single aggravating factor. And Representative Spano touched on this. But Pariente said that that could be an issue with the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. Can you tell us about that issue? What kind of aggravating factors do juries consider in potential death penalty cases?
From what I understand, Florida has the most aggravating factors. So there's a broad array of things that prosecutors can bring to juries saying this is a reason why you should vote for death. They can look at how heinous the crime was. They can look at patterns of prior crimes. In some cases, that is a little bit restrictive. They can look at whether the crime was motivated to kill a witness. They can look at things like whether a police officer was killed. There are, I believe, 17 aggravating factors in Florida.
And has the state Supreme Court given any indication as to when they might render a ruling on the Hearst v. Florida case?
They haven't. They generally don't. They will probably want to rule fairly soon because there are a bunch of cases that are held up by this.
Right, and in the meantime, we're effectively under a moratorium as far as actually carrying out executions, correct?
Yes, at this point, there will be none.
Mm-hmm. We're exploring the future of the death penalty in Florida as the state Supreme Court works to address the state's death penalty sentencing system. We're talking with Republican State Representative Ross Spano, journalist Susanna Nesmith, and Robert Dunham with the Death Penalty Information Center. Connect with our guests with your comments and questions by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Write to us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live, or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Mr. Dunham, tell us generally about the work and mission of the Death Penalty Information Center.
Well, the Death Penalty Information Center is a nonprofit organization that essentially tracks developments with the death penalty. We don't take a position for or against the death penalty as a whole, but we do examine problems and the manner in which it's being administered. So we try to give accurate information and a national perspective on developments in death penalty issues.
And who are the reports and analysis that the center creates intended for? Is this for folks working in the legal system, the general public?
For the public.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
although I should say that journalists like me use those reports a lot.
Oh, sure.
They're very useful.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's been the overall trend in the U.S., you know, when it comes to capital punishment, you know, stepping out of specifically Florida? I'd been under the impression that it had been in decline.
That's right. There's been a long-term decline in the death penalty in the United States. If you go back to the 1990s, in the mid-90s, there were 315 people sentenced to death in 94 and in 96. We had 3 years in a row where there were 300 or more people who were sentenced to death. Last year, the total was under 50. And if you look at the number of death sentences imposed in the last 10 years, in that decade, there are actually fewer death sentences that were imposed in the United States than there were in the decade leading to the Supreme Court's decision in 1972 when they threw out existing death penalty statutes. And the drop in the number of death sentences also follows the decline in the level of public support for the death penalty. Again, in the late 80s, we were looking at public support for the death penalty that was almost as high as 80% in a Gallup poll. If you just ask the question, do you support or oppose the death penalty? The latest Gallup poll has that support down 19 percentage points at 61, and a poll by Pew Research had support for the death penalty at 56. And then when you ask the next question, not do you support the death penalty in the abstract, but what is the appropriate punishment for murder? Is it death? Is it life without possibility of parole or what? It turns out that a majority of Americans say that life without parole is more appropriate as a punishment than murder. And in Florida, when a recent poll was done after the Hearst decision, in fact, a majority of Democrats, Republicans, and independents all favored a life option over the death penalty.
Hmm. I know a few years ago, the Death Penalty Information Center put out a report titled Struck by Lightning. I was hoping that you could highlight that for us and you know, tell us what that informs regarding uniformity or lack thereof in death sentencing and executions.
Yeah, that report looked at essentially the arbitrary factors that are present in virtually every state that has the death penalty. And we followed it up with a report just 2 years ago called the 2% death penalty, which explored where the death penalty actually is imposed. And what we've seen is that systematically there are arbitrary factors that lead to death sentences. The single most likely factor the one factor that's more likely than any other to lead to somebody being capitally charged and being sentenced to death is not what happened in the crime. It's where it happened. 2% of the counties in the United States are responsible for more than half of all the death sentences in the United States. And 85% of the counties in the United States don't have anybody on death row at all. So there really are these geographic outliers. And what we see in those outliers are very aggressive prosecutorial practices. And we tend to see a whole range of problems in the criminal justice system in those counties. Not just aggressively seeking the death penalty, but there also tend to be discriminatory use of discretionary strikes to remove African Americans and other minorities from the juries. We tend to see greater instances of police violence directed at civilians and other forms of prosecutorial misconduct. so what we discovered was that where you have large concentrations of death sentences, it's really a symptom of deeper problems in the criminal justice system as a whole.
And I would add that you listeners, again, should go check out The Village's Daily Sun. Katie Sartoris did another investigation looking at disparities within Florida. And it really depends on where you commit a murder, whether the prosecutor is going to seek the death penalty and whether you are likely to get it. The disparities are huge.
I think the Daily Sun story was the research they've done has been tremendous. One of the other things that that their research and ours have pointed out, and this ties back to the question of unanimity, is that when you seek death more in a jurisdiction, you're likely to have more death penalties overturned. What we also found is that when you have a non-unanimous jury, it really does point to the lack of reliability of the resulting death sentence. 90% of the exonerations from death row in Florida are cases in which there was not a unanimous jury recommendation for death.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is about all the time we have for today's show. But thanks so much to my guests, freelance journalist Susanna Nesmith. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Robert Dunham, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Earlier in the conversation, we were speaking with Republican State Representative Ross Spano. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and AJ Leonard. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.